always have to have a stern talk with God after he has a chant like that. How is he expecting me to say anything? Marking the day of one's birth always brings to mind going back to the beginning. And I've been privileged in my lifetime to have God have me remember many early scenes in my own life. And I thought I would read from Master's Expanded Commentary on the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 1, verse 1. From the moment of conception to the surrender of the last breath, man has to fight in each incarnation innumerable battles, biological, hereditary, bacteriological, physiological, climatic, social, ethical, political, sociological, psychological, metaphysical, so many varieties of inner and outer conflicts. Isn't it so? Competing for victory in every encounter are the forces of good and evil. The whole intent of the Gita is to align man's effort on the side of Dharma, or righteousness. The ultimate aim of self is realization, self-realization, the realization of man's true self, the soul, as made in the image of God, one with ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever new bliss of spirit. I think there's probably never so fine of a summary of not only the Gita and its message, but what the Master's message is to us. The first contest of the soul in each incarnation is with other souls seeking rebirth. With the union of a sperm and an ovum, to begin the formation of a new human body, a flash of light appears in the astral world, the heavenly home of souls between incarnations. That light transmits a pattern which attracts a soul according to that soul's karma. The self-created influences from actions of past lives. In each incarnation, karma works itself out partly through hereditary forces. The soul of a child is attracted into a family in which heredity is in conformance with the child's past karma. Many souls vie to enter this new cell of life. Only one will be victorious. In the case of multiple conception, more than one primal cell is present. Within the body, the mother's body, the unborn child struggles against disease, darkness, and periodic feelings of limitation and frustration, as the soul consciousness in the unborn child remembers and then gradually forgets its greater freedom of expression during its astral sojourn. And here perhaps was a difference between Master and I, in that when I was in the womb and remembering, God took me into this experience and curled me up in a fetal position. This happened when I was an adult. And I remembered being in my mother's womb. I could hear her heartbeat softly in rhythm. I could feel the warmth, the comfort. And somewhere on the outer edges of my mind, I was also aware of the incarnation I was about to take. I wasn't thrilled about coming into the outer world. I really liked being where I was. And so when my mother told me that I had been breech-born, I could just imagine myself with my feet up against the interior side of the wall saying, "You'll have to take me out of here dead, coppers, in order to get me out." But out I came. My mother said the doctor's up to his elbows getting me turned around inside. So she had stitches afterwards, I know that. And I wasn't able to move for some time. So I wasn't enthusiastic about coming out. And I remembered my astral family, and it's a higher astral realm, and loving that family and the people that I was around. And it explained to me why, when I came into this incarnation, I was born into a good family, but I always felt like somehow they weren't my family. And I was unconsciously, at that point, comparing them against my astral family that I had had, and it just didn't seem to match up so well. I remembered them, and so instead of fully appreciating the family that I had, I found them somewhat short of the goal. The soul within the embryo also has to contend with karma, which influencing for good or ill the formation of the body in which it is now a resident. Additionally, it encounters the vibratory influences that reach it from the outside, the environment and actions of the mother, the external sounds and sensations, the vibrations of love and hate, peace and anger. And in regards to the formation of the body, this is a vision that God gave to me one time where I saw that the imprint of the individual's consciousness operates on the genetic predisposition of the body that it's given, but there are many decisions that are made as that body develops. And certain genetics, genes, can be switched on or off. Scientists are beginning to understand this more and more today. They're beginning to talk about that these genetic factors can be changed by circumstance, by environment, by somebody's thoughts, by somebody's attitudes. And so it's not a sentence as if we have to have a certain disease or a certain thing happen to us. We can change those genetic variances, turn certain gates off, turn certain gates on. And this is a tremendously hopeful kind of thing. You don't have to look at your parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles and so on in order to see what kind of genetic soup you've been handed, as if you just have nothing to do with it. That you can change your circumstance, you can change your body entirely. And you can turn off certain genes, you can turn on others, others of health and of vibrancy. And every aspect, the more that you are in touch, particularly with the superior forces of divine consciousness, it gives you the ability to change everything about you. Master described how in one case there was a saint who had had a terrible disease and he was crippled and could barely sit to meditate at all. But by tremendous strength of will and attunement to the divine, he continued until he could sit for long stretches at a time, completely absent of the body. And one day when he came out of his deep meditation state, he started to move in his body, and suddenly his body was all right, as it never had been affected by disease at all. And he hadn't done one thing other than to deeply attune himself with God. Mother told the story of meeting a great saint, and for years he had not been able to get up or down without assistance, and he had a certain kind of paralysis in his body. And he and Mother spoke for some time, and Mother was lit up with the power of God and feeling the power of God flow through her. And when she and he were done with the talk, the man got up unassisted, got down on his knees and pranam fully at her feet, and then got back up without any assistance at all. He had been healed of this malady that had been affected him so long. And Mother hadn't attempted any kind of a cure other than she was completely caught up in the feeling of God. And this is the way that many great saints heal others, not necessarily of their own volition. One time there were devotees sitting around Papa, and one of them said, "Papa, you know all of our thoughts. You're always reading our minds." And Papa said, "Why would he lower himself to such a realm as to reading your mind? He only wants to know the mind of God." But you see, it is through the mind of God that he could attune himself to the individuality of every person who is there. And he might give him something about that person's past. Sometimes when I'm sitting with an individual, God will lift me up into a certain state in the asana, and I will see through these physical eyes the person's face transform. And they will look exactly as they looked in a previous lifetime. Sometimes it is that a man changes into a woman or a woman into a man. Sometimes a Caucasian will take on dark skin, the nose, the features, everything changes, the hair changes, everything. And a lot of information comes about that individual's previous incarnation. And there's not anything that I do. I'm not trying to focus on anything in particular about them. I'm just sitting them with them in the presence of God, and God does everything else. And so it's a fascinating story that we've been on, this journey of life. We think of it as starting with our birth, but that's not the case at all. This journey that we've been on reaches far back in time for most of us. And it started in our journey into this creation, that God created everything that is, and He wanted the play. He's interested in this play. It's His expression. It's an expression of His very self, just even as an architect or an artist expresses a part of themselves in their art or in their architecture. But you would never say that that piece of art or that architecture is a complete expression of the individual who created it. It's just an aspect of that individual. And even so, God has created all of this, and He has become that. And it is a part of Him. And yet He resides separate from His own creation. And so He wanted us to enjoy this creation. He wanted us to enjoy this life. And intuitively, we knew that there are certain proscriptions around coming into this lifetime that really, if we lived life correctly, we would always be in remembrance of Him, that our connection with God would come first. But for many of us, and God gave us free will, and so we were able to experiment with that, and we became fascinated. I remember one of my earliest incarnations was into flowing lava. And I was watching this lava flow through spiritual vision, and I wondered what it was like to be like this living rock that was moving and growing and then subsiding and then hardening. And so I was, just by thinking about it, just having that desire, I moved into that lava, and I felt myself flowing with it and moving with it, and then over much, much time, gradually cooling and hardening with it and turning it into absolute rock. And while I was in this experience, temporarily I forgot who I was in my totality in God. And then I recovered that, and I thought that was very interesting. That was fascinating, wonderful. And then what it would be like to be in other incarnations, what it would be like to be in vegetative life, and feeling the cells grow and reach up for the light, feeling the roots go into the ground and draw nurturance and strength and water coming up through the roots. The whole experience, you see. And so it's all there for us to enjoy. But what God asks us to do is not to get too involved, not to get involved to the extent that we would forget Him and our connection with Him, because that would draw a veil of ignorance between ourselves and the infinite. But most all of us who are sitting here made that choice, and we got fascinated with this. And in the knowledge that we are always one with God, then we took the chance, we took the risk, we became so involved in this world that we became very, very much a part of it. And we went through the evolutionary ranks. And as we did so, we finally came into human evolvement. And in human evolvement, we have this wonderful creation. It is unique in this world plane, in that it contains all seven spheres of consciousness that can be awakened right within this body, in that there are these centers within the body. They are not physical themselves, although they are associated with physical parts of our body, starting with the base of the spine and working up to the top of the head. And we have this capacity for experiencing our conscious union with God. And thus, we enter on to the last phase of this evolutionary process. And Meher Baba said that by the time that we get to human evolution, just to human birth itself, we are 90% there toward the end goal. Isn't that encouraging? And how much more so then when you become conscious of wanting this union with God? How much even more so? That must put this into the top 99 percentile of the ranking there. And yet, we live with ourselves, we live with our humanness, and we're so conscious of our limitations. But isn't it better that we become more conscious of God within us? Because where the mind is, the rest will follow. And if we are completely absorbed in God, everything else will be drawn to that. But as we know, as we try to put our full attention upon the asana, and we're lifted up into God experience, and we taste that freedom for just a brief while, and then we're brought down. And what's the polar opposite of being at the top of the head? It's being at the base of the spine. And there are the primal feelings of survival, of sexuality, of looking out for that opposite through the opposite sex and trying to find somebody who's our perfect complement. And so these begin to get activated when the spiritual energy begins to flow in the spine, because everything is ramped up. And now where you direct your mind takes even greater kind of life force. So it can seem odd to us, just as we're really trying to put our minds on God and take ourselves up, that the temptations, the fears around physical death and so on, can grow stronger, it seems like. That sexual desire nature grows stronger. The desire for power grows stronger. And the reason is because you have activated powerful forces within you. And now your mind is directing them. And if you let them be drawn down to those lower centers, it draws this powerful life energy with it and activates those centers, sometimes as never before. This is you being tested. This is you facing your past and overcoming those karmic influences that limit you. And so it becomes absolutely an essential factor that you learn to control your mind, because where your mind goes to, the rest of you follows. And so you go on to a great journey with that, and a great experimentation. And as much as you feel attracted to God, as soon as you direct your mind down to the lower centers, then you are drawn down to those as well. And so it goes. You're on the polar opposites, and this takes you all the way up the spine. Master continues, after birth, the struggles of the infant are between its instincts to seek comfort and survival and the opposing relative helplessness in its immature bodily instrument. A child begins his first conscious struggle when he has to choose between his desires to play aimlessly and his desire to learn, study, and pursue some course of systematic training. Gradually, more serious battles arise, forced upon him by karmic instincts from within or by bad company and environment without. The youth finds himself confronted suddenly with a host of problems that he has often been ill-prepared to meet. Temptations of sex, greed, prevarication, money-making by easy but questionable means, pressure from company he keeps, and social influences. The youth usually discovers he possesses no sword of wisdom with which to fight the invading armies of worldly experiences. The adult who lives without cultivating and employing his innate powers of wisdom and spiritual discrimination finds inexorably that the kingdom of his body and mind is being overrun by the insurgence of misery-making wrong desires, destructive habits, failure, ignorance, disease, and unhappiness. Few men are even aware that a state of constant warfare exists in their kingdom. Usually it is only when the devastation is nearly complete that man helplessly realizes the sad ruin of their lives. The psychological conflict of health, prosperity, self-control, and wisdom has to be started anew each day in order for man to advance towards victory, reclaiming inch by inch the territories of the soul occupied by the rebels of ignorance. The yogi, the awakening man, is confronted not only with the external battles fought by all men, but also with the internal clash between the negative forces of restlessness arising from manas, or the sense consciousness, and the positive power of his desire and effort to meditate, supported by buddhi, intelligence. When he tries to reestablish himself in the soul's inner spiritual kingdom, the subtle centers of life and divine consciousness in the spine and the brain. And thereby we enter into the battle of life. Occasionally I have somebody ask me, well, isn't there a better way of thinking about it than a battle? And I can't think of any. It just seems to be true. It is a battle. It's difficult. And we do seem ill-prepared. We come into this realm, as I say, most oftentimes from the astral realms. If people are of a lower consciousness, they may just go to sleep, so to speak, into the big sleep at the point of death. And when they are ready and when circumstances are ready, then they're aroused and come back into a birth in this lifetime, and they have little or no experience in the astral realms. It seems very vague to them. But the higher the soul goes, the more that they become ready and attuned to their higher nature and remembrance of it when they come back into this realm. The great Ramakrishna said that one day he was meditating and he's lifted up into the high causal realms. And there he saw a beautiful light, a beautiful soul. And he is so enamored with this soul, and he says, will you come down to earth in order to help me with my mission? And that beautiful light made an agreement and said, yes, I will come. And that Ramakrishna looked for him for many years. And finally, one day, Narendranath, who eventually became Swami Vivekananda, walked in through the door. And he soon recognized him as his soul that he had met up in this high realm. Many great masters bring with them souls, not only because there is a personal connection, but they have come to help in that master's mission in coming to this earth. We oftentimes think, well, if I get my freedom and when I earn my freedom, I'll never come back to this mud ball again. It's not worth it. And it is because we think of ignorance as associated with being in this material world. It's because this material world represents that ignorance. When you put your mind on the highest consciousness and you get this tug of war that goes between the top of your spine, the heart center, the sixth chakra at the ajna, the seventh center at the top of the head. And that's competing with the three lower forces down at the base of the spine, the sexual consciousness, and the individual power consciousness. And back and forth you go, and it's because these lower centers are drawn to this world. They're attached to this world. They see this world as the source of happiness. And little do they imagine that it's also the source of pain. When everything's going our way, when we think life is wonderful, and we're totally dedicated to this life, we think, what's not to like? And then something happens, then we lose a love, somebody that we love very much, we get ill, we are shamed in front of others, and we are put into a position of feeling powerless, and we think, oh my gosh, why did I ever get into this mess? And we think, how do I get out of it? But we don't think of ascending into the kingdom of heaven. We just think, how can I get on top of the game again? How can I get healthy? How can I find somebody that I can love and who loves me back, how can I gain power in this world? And so this is the game of most people. Even when they complain about life, they're not really looking to get out of it. They're just looking to improve their lot. And you see that many times with people who come to see saints in India. And they ask them, please heal me of these. Please cure this financial condition. Please help me find somebody in life to marry. And they're just looking to improve their own lives, which is all right. And from a human standpoint, that's a good thing. But how few people actually seek God? One time I was in a course that was talking about how to plan things and how to prioritize your days and your life. And he said, I want you to pull out your day planner and your checkbook. He said, these will tell me what your priorities are. And everybody groaned in the room because we've just been talking about priorities and people have been writing down these lofty goals. And then when you actually get to how you spend your days and spend your money, is it reflected in what your top priorities are? What you say are the highest goals in your life. And so oftentimes they're out of sync. They're not together. And it's a reason why people are unhappy. It's because we're not in sync with who and what we truly should be. This life is a wonderful life. And even with its ups and its downs, if we could but conceive of it as really being wonderful, and even if we find ourselves in circumstances we wouldn't call wonderful, we're not thrilled with them. If you can take those circumstances and turn them into a ladder towards climbing to the divine, all right, God, let this be a reminder to me. This body is untrustworthy. Friends and loved ones can even be untrustworthy. There is nothing that I can hang on to this life with absolute certainty short of you. And so I want to put you first. And when you whip me with these reminders of how bad life can be, let me take it to heart. Let me root out that ignorance that's so deeply embedded in my conscious and subconscious mind. You know, we're not even always aware of our own attachments to this life. And we have to grow in that awareness. I remember in my own path as I was meditating deeper, and this great fear, I was not somebody who lived with a lot of fear, but this great fear began to take me over. And every time I sat down on my meditation blanket, I can tell you, it's the last place in the world that I wanted to be. Because all I had to do was sit down there and suddenly this great fear would take me over. And so I had to fight through it. I had to keep going. I could easily see why somebody would walk away from that after a few times with that, much less after going through months and a couple of years of experiencing that. And yet, day after day, I found myself going back to that place. I was determined in order to overcome that. Why would I want to live with that limitation? Why would I want to live with that fear as an ongoing factor in my life, even if it was in the deep subterraneans of the unconscious mind, and I didn't live with it consciously so much? Nevertheless, it was still there. So we have to be willing to face those things. And they come up. They come up in subtle ways. If you find yourself just wanting to avoid being where you're at on your spiritual path, not wanting to face something, that's exactly what you ought to be doing. And it's not easy. We'd like to think that when we enter into the spiritual path, well, I'm doing everything right. I had a telephone call the other day. I'm doing everything right, and yet everything in my life seems to be going wrong. And it's unconsciously, we think we make a deal with God. We say, okay, I'll start to behave. I've been misbehaving all this time, but I'll begin to behave. And if I begin to behave, then life is going to go smoother, right? Money is going to come easier. Business is going to go smoother. Health is going to get better. And if it doesn't, we feel betrayed by God, of all things. And it is because that the deal that we make with God is that when I put my mind on you, when I become determined in this path, I get you. My circumstances may not look all that much different. I may not get the promotion at work. I may not get cured of a particular illness. But I get you. And that's the deal that we make with God. Because we have this karmic pattern, and yes, some of it is taken by God, some of it's taken by the Guru, but there's a portion that we have to earn ourselves. And that is because unless we do, we don't get stronger, you see. We have to exercise those muscles. And when we get to the end of our own strength, then we begin to draw upon God's strength. We break that barrier of separation. But if something comes to us in life that we don't like, and we just get bitter and resentful that this, well, I don't want anything to do with a God that brings about this kind of situation, and we begin to push God away, it happens all over the place, I guarantee you. We're learning the wrong lesson, and we're getting the wrong law of cause and effect. God did not create this situation. We did. And if God deems it appropriate that we should have to face it, it's for a purpose. It's to bring out greater connection with God. It's to overcome our fear. There are so many stories of people who get serious illnesses. And if in their recovery they begin to get better, oftentimes they'll say, that illness was the best thing that ever happened for me. It broke something deep inside of me. Perhaps they unconsciously knew always that something was going to happen like that, or perhaps their unconsciousness created those conditions. But by facing those conditions, and particularly when we draw more deeply upon God, we change ourselves, we grow spiritually. And so everything that we overcome in that sense, that we go beyond the illness, we go beyond our reaction to that illness, or that situation of poverty, or whatever it is that God has given us, and that we connect with God, we feel God's presence, we feel His guidance on our own thoughts, we feel His love being expressed in our own heart. The years, long years when I was a single individual, and particularly as a young man, and I was thinking, you know, really, I would really like to meet somebody that I could love specially and that somebody would love specially back to me. But nobody was on the horizon, you know, and just kind of wanting it to be so doesn't make it so. And so I thought, well, what do I do with all of this? It seems like such a powerful force inside of me. And so as I read about Ramakrishna and Saint Francis in particular, they were helping to awaken that bhakti within me. And I thought, well, I want to love God. I want to give God all of this. I want to look to God. As long as I don't have a human being around to do that, then God will be that. He'll be my lover, my beloved, my friend, my everything. And so I took all of that yearning, all of that desire, and I turned it to God. And I said, God, you be that. You fill this hole, this void that I feel deep inside of me. You fill it with yourself. And He took me at my word. And He has done so. It didn't happen in a day. And it happened progressively over time. And at each time that I felt that vacancy, that emptiness, that hole deep inside of me, I had to face it all new again. I had to invite God in all over again. But it says in the Bible, to all them who received Him gave He power to become sons of God. Receiving Him has very deep meaning here. Sometimes people think that going down to the altar and saying that they accept Jesus Christ as their Lord and their Savior is receiving Him. But that's just the beginning of the journey. That's just scratching the surface. It's going through every element of our humanness and receiving the Christ into that element of humanness. And there are things that we find about ourselves that are disgusting, that are dark, that are anything but filled with God. And those are exactly the places where we need to receive the Christ, where we need to receive the light. We hold it aside as if it would be objectionable to God, as if God has never viewed anything so disgusting in his life, and yet God created this, all of this life. Of course God knows that. And he receives us anyway. He receives us, but do we receive him? I'd like to read to you from the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, a favorite book of mine. And the Master is saying, Ramakrishna is saying here, well, it seems to me that both the formless deity and God are with form, are real. What do you say? And this is a Brahmo Samaj preacher, and he is somebody who only believes in the formless aspect. They didn't like the idea of God with image. Sir, I compare the formless God to the electric current, which is not seen with the eyes but can be felt. The Master says, yes, both are true. God with form is as real as God without form. Do you know what describing God as being formless only is like? It is like a man playing only a monotone on his flute, though it has seven holes. But on the same instrument, another man plays different melodies. Likewise, in how many ways the believers in a personal God enjoy him. They enjoy him through the many different attitudes, the serene attitude, the attitude of a servant, a friend, a mother, a husband, a lover. You see, the thing is somehow or other to get into the lake of nectar of immortality. Suppose some person gets into it by propitiating the deity with hymns and worship. And you are pushed into it. The result will be the same. Both of you will certainly become immortal. And so isn't this wonderful? There's a big discussion that goes on in India. Is God formless or is he with form? And Vaishnavites, for instance, will argue Krishna is God. And they focus on the form of Krishna. And that to them is the supreme expression of God. And others will say, no, never think on anything less than the formless aspect of God. And you must go to the supreme aspect. But the flute has seven holes in it. Your spine has seven places in it. And to play all of those parts of the flute. So you take all of your humanness, everything that you experience in that way, and you turn it towards God. You see, you can think of denying or objecting and going beyond each one of those. That's the path of the yoni. Not this, not that. God is not this and not that. And when you cut away everything that God is not, what are you left with? God alone. And yet, the bhakti takes the very human elements that are seen as being what is blocking you from knowing God fully, and you turn it to God. And so the desire for human love gets turned into desire for divine love. And so sometimes people take the image of baby Krishna, and they think of this baby Krishna. He's a naughty little baby. He used to take the butter that the milkmaids would make, and he'd steal some of that butter, and he'd go and he'd give it to the other children, and he'd give it to the monkeys, and everybody, he'd give it away to everybody. And the other milkmaids, they would become very frustrated with Krishna because they worked hard. They milked the cows and then they churned it, and only to have this child to steal this butter and take it away. And so they would come to Yashoda, his stepmother, his adopted mother, and they would say, oh, he's such a naughty boy, you have to discipline him. And so he had this butter, jar of butter that was right next to him that was empty, and the mother was so upset with him because these other mothers had come to her so often. So she demanded to look into his mouth. She says, show me your mouth. And she expected to find a whole wad of butter in there because it looked like he had just taken a wad and put it in. And he opened up his mouth, and when she looked into his mouth, what did she see? The entire universe. Well, that was rather startling to her, not seeing the butterball. She saw the whole universe. And in this way, little baby Krishna indicated that he wasn't an ordinary little child. And so she walked away, completely frustrated in her purpose of disciplining himself. And so people in India, they love to hear these stories. And they delight in thinking about this baby Krishna. Another time, he was being very naughty. And so she decided, Yashoda decided to tie him up. So she tied an end of string around his tummy. And then she reached the string out to tie it around a post that was on the table there. And she wanted to keep him in one place where she could keep an eye on him. And when she went to tie that string, there wasn't enough length to reach to the post. So she got some more string and she tied that together and she went to tie it to the post. And there wasn't enough string again. And piece after piece after piece, she kept tying on there and she couldn't get to it. And finally, she was just so frustrated. She was sweating and her hair was hanging down in her face and she started just about ready to cry. She's so frustrated. And she looked at him so pleadingly that he nodded his head and he gave his assent to be tied up. And then she was able to easily reach to the post on the leg. And so these wonderful stories come down to us. And just by hearing the stories, by meditating on him, by loving this darling little child. In India, you see these children. And if they're not cute enough already, they put makeup on their eyes and they put little bangles on their legs and their chubby little legs and their arms. And they're just delightful, just delightful. And it's all done in honor like Krishna, because he would wear that kind of eyeliner and makeup, which was the custom at the time. And they love their children, and they see Krishna in their children, and their hearts are awakened. And they just love. Love pours out of them. Now, when that love takes you to God, and you feel that love flowing out through your heart, and it transmits you up into divine realms. It's not just a human love. But you see God in that child. You see God. You see, what difference does it make? What takes you to the absolute? There's so much argument. We see that in the world of Islam, there shouldn't be any representations of God. And there's a high truth in this, in the sense that God is beyond any form and any image. But if there is a form that focuses your mind and lifts you up into the divine, God will see to it that you're taken beyond that form and into the absolute. We should always see that any form of God is but a transitional metaphor that will take us to the fullness of God realization. It's never the absolute in that sense. And so let us focus our minds on attaining the very highest, but seek the avenue that is right for you. There are some who are strong bhaktis, and they want to worship that form. There's nothing wrong with that, as long as we don't limit God to that form only. And we always know that that form is like an open doorway. And as we approach it, it will take us into the greater aspect of God. I wanted to read one other portion here out of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. The king lives beyond seven gates. At each gate sits a man endowed with great power and glory. At each gate the visitor asks, "Is this the king?" The gatekeeper answers, "No, not this, not this." The visitor passes through the seventh gate and becomes overpowered with joy. He is speechless. This time he doesn't have to ask, "Is this the king?" The mere sight of him removes all doubts. And isn't that wonderful? Let us never take our eyes off of the goal. It's too easy in this lifetime to get distracted with the things of the world only. We have come for a high purpose. And how sad it is when we come into this world with that high purpose and we want to attain to it with everything in our heart. But then we get into the midst of action and we forget who we are. We forget why we have come. We get imbued with all of these things of the world. And then when we wake up at that moment of death to our true soul's purpose, we feel such a deep regret deep inside of us. This life is wonderful, but it offers something so much more than what we can get just through these five senses. Wanted to read you something from the East West magazine. And this is dated March of 1954. That's the year of my birth, and I think that's why I picked it out. But I think this is wonderful. This is relating to Master's birthday on January 5th. Special meditation services were held on January 5th in all SRF churches and colonies to commemorate Paramahansaji's birthday. It is the custom of the disciples at Mount Washington Center to purchase each year a live Christmas tree, which is decorated in place in Master's apartment for the holidays, then transplanted to the grounds outside on his birthday. One day, the Mount Washington hillside will be dotted with graceful deodoras, the tree he loves so much, and it's quite wonderful. One year, he planted a deodora out in our backyard here in commemoration of Master, knowing that it was his favorite tree. Rajasi Janakananda, Master's chief disciple, spent the day in seclusion. Later, he recounted to the other disciples a wonderful experience that day he had had on that hallowed day. I awoke around 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning of January 5th and saw Lari Mahasaya in a great blaze of light in which he has ever manifested to me. Then, one by one, Sri Yukteswar, Babaji, and Master appeared. Master lifted me out of the body and we floated together over many gatherings of people. Master blessed each group as we floated over it. We were not walking, but floating overhead. It seemed as though Master wanted all the people to know I was with him. I was with Master a long time, from 2 or 3 o'clock until 9 o'clock, the longest I have been with him in this way. Master is very busy there, so this is 1954, this is 2 years after Master's leaving the body. Master is very busy there, meaning the astral realms, just as busy as he was when he was here in the physical realm, helping the people in these other spheres, teaching them the way of salvation and how to achieve self-realization themselves. Isn't that wonderful? Let us not miss out on the things that this life has to offer us. We were born here for a purpose. And whatever your state that you've attained to, it's the human mind's natural tendency to limit you, to think, oh, well, I know God, I feel God, I experience God. But always open your mind to what you have yet not experienced, even if it's just a felt sense without any knowledge or even sense of what that more is, just knowing that there is more. Knowing that the tendency of your human mind is to wrap a box around God, put a label on it, put it up on the shelf, and think you got that one pretty well wired. How wrong we would be. How wrong we would be. Each day when you enter into meditation, think of the excitement, think of the potential, the possibilities. Without even knowing what those are, open yourself to the greatness of what God is and say, all right, God, you're taking me on a guided tour of yourself. What is in store for us today? And as you enter into your day, no day is the same as the other. That's the tendency of the human mind. I don't know what it is to be bored. I can't imagine being bored in this lifetime. I would have no idea what that is. Every day, every moment is an unfolding and an openness to the greatness of God. And it doesn't mean that fantastical things happen every day. It can be looking at a flower and the beauty of the construct of that flower. It can be looking at the ear of a child and the beauty of the construct of that child. It can be involved with your work and just enjoying what you're doing. And it can be a very mundane thing. I remember one day when I was moving from a house and a devotee offered to come and visit and help me clean, as recover the cleaning deposit and leave it as a very nice place. And here she was scrubbing toilets and scrubbing floors, and at the end of this day, and her hair was hanging down, and she had been working hard all day, and she said, "You might not be able to believe this, this is the best day of my life." Can you imagine? This is what it's like when your mind is tuned to God, when your heart is open to God. Do not think that you have to experience anything special in the mysterious kind of sense, other than what life has to offer you itself. It's a miracle in itself. I don't remember who the author was, but he said either nothing is a miracle or everything is a miracle. And it's true. It's true. The miraculous is to be found for those who have the eyes to see it and the ears to hear it. And those who are dullards don't experience any mystery, don't experience any of the mystery of what this life is. How sad and pathetic. Where are you blocking yourself from knowing God more? Where can you open yourself to a greater vision, a greater knowledge, a greater bliss of God? In what ways is your mind closed to Him? Sometimes you hear things in a spiritual talk, or you'll read something, "Oh yeah, I know that," and you so easily dismiss it. Do you know that? Have you plumbed the depths of it? Do you know it as great as the master who wrote it or said it? And if you do not, you do not know it. You know it partially, but not fully, not completely. So be careful of the human ego and the human mind and the way that it speaks to you, the way that it draws you away from what God is. What God is, no one can say. But the way can be pointed. The tools can be given by which you can begin to exercise this mind in such a way that it opens itself up to the greatness of what God is. Verily, you are the temple of the living God. In all of its infinity, I remember once when God lifted me up into a deep state of meditation, and then He took me to the center of my spine. In the center of my spine, I saw the entirety of the universe, believe it or not. Now, where would I have to go when I have the entirety of the universe right in the center of my spine? Sounds like an odd thing, but it's true. You have it all within you. Seize this moment, seize this day, and open yourself up to the greatness of what God is. And there is more, and there is more, and more. And this would be a depressing fact from an ego standpoint, but from a spiritual standpoint, it's thrilling that God can continue to expand Himself in you, and that there is no limit to it. Let us pray together. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
And surrender myself to Thee.
And surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with Thee.
Of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Thank you for sharing this day, marking this anniversary point. You know, in the first years of getting onto the spiritual path, I had no friends to share it with. And even after meeting Mother, God saw to it. I was offered a job, and the day before I was to get the job, they went on strike in Alaska, which closed down the plant down here, and I didn't get the job, and so I had to move away. And so I spent time away from Mother and the spiritual group, and I came when I could. And it wasn't until years later that I was able to come and really form friendships within the spiritual group and get to know people. And I treasure it because I spent that time without kindred spirits on the path. And it means so much to me that we're able to share this journey together and be together on this path, going to God together. I can't think of anything better. And how much I treasure that and I value that in my heart. So thank you.